From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Kevin Turner, and this is the Autosport Podcast. Well, welcome to the latest episode of our look at the best seasons in F1 history to celebrate 75 years of both Autosport and the World Championship for Drivers. And instead of listening to me waffle on through one of my top 10s, we've decided to ask some special guests in to talk about their favourite season and explain why they think it was the best. And joining me is a very special guest who's got very much experience going back in lots of different roles, journalist, commentator, podcast host, James Allen. James, welcome to the Autosport Podcast. How are you doing?
Thank you. Thank you, Kevin. No, it's great to be here. It's exciting. It's a great project.
Yeah, it's good fun. Basically, we get to, I think we'd broadly agree on most of the years. I don't think there's going to be any particularly outrageous disagreements, but it's quite good to look back at these seasons. So tell us, which season have you selected and why?
So I've gone for 1993 because it was a season with very big personalities in it. The cars were unbelievable in those days. They sounded great. You had three different kinds of engines. You had V8s, V10s, and V12s. They looked fast, you know, on telly. They looked fast.
They looked good, I think. Apart from the Benetton, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. They were loaded with technology, which then got banned at the end of that season. And there were just so many amazing backstories to the whole thing. As I say, huge characters. And it was my third year in Formula One. And as you can imagine, it made a very big impression on me.
I really like this as a choice because I think a lot of the seasons we're going to look at in this series have been ones with a close championship fight. That's what people tend to sort of focus on, and that we haven't got that in this case. Alain Prost clinched the championship quite comfortably, really. So just looking at the stats, Prost won 7 races for Williams. Ayrton Senna somehow managed to win 5 races for McLaren. Damon Hill, the rookie for Williams, won 3, and some bloke called Marcus Schumacher at Benetton got just a single win. But if you look at the poles, I think that tells the story in terms of pace. 13 poles for Prost, 2 for Damon Hill, and just 1 for Ayrton Senna, who some would regard as the greatest qualifier of all time. And Williams did have a 1.7% advantage on raw pace, which is the fourth most dominant in F1 history. So not really the ingredients that you'd necessarily have for a great season. But as you say, big characters. But I guess we should start with the story of the character that wasn't there, and that is that the reigning world champion wasn't there to defend his title in 93.
Yeah, I think you have to look at 93 in the context of what didn't happen, because basically Nigel Mansell had gone back to Williams. He'd been very competitive in 91 against Senna. And they'd had a wonderful battle for the world championship. And then, of course, they came up with this active Williams car for 1992 that was a total world beater. And Nigel was just untouchable in it with an amazing, amazing performance. But behind the scenes, there was all kinds of shenanigans going on, because Alain Prost had taken a sabbatical in 1992. And he, because of his connections through Renault and Elf, in particular the fuel company, had lined up to drive for Williams in 1993. Now, Mansell was the incumbent, and he was becoming world champion in Hungary, and he was negotiating his new deal with Frank Williams, and the deal was on the table. And then, completely out of left field, during that Hungarian Grand Prix weekend, when Nigel clinched the world championship in record time, I think at that time it was the earliest anyone had ever clinched a world championship, Ayrton Senna comes out and offers to drive for Williams for nothing the following year. So, of course, it's this tremendous bombshell. And Mansell agreed the deal with Frank Williams, and then he's waiting for the paperwork to come through on the Monday morning. It doesn't come through. He's chasing it and one thing and another. And then one of the Williams directors rings him up and says that Frank's instructed him, because of the situation with Ayrton, who's standing by to sign a contract, he can now only offer him half the money that he was originally, that they'd agreed in Hungary. So Nigel, of course, as you can imagine, Nigel being Nigel, was not best pleased about this. They carried on negotiating right up to when he basically went into the press office in Monza and announced his retirement from Formula One. He'd obviously lined up. There was no shortage of offers, because the IndyCar were desperate to have him. Bernie Eccleston was pulling his hair out because he was about to lose one of his biggest stars. And the whole thing was just absolutely incredible. I was sort of there. I covered it. I covered Nigel's. I was working with ESPN at the time, as well as working as the news editor on Autosport, believe it or not. So it was an absolutely unbelievable situation that then basically left us with Alain Prost as the team leader for 1993 with Williams, and Damon Hill, who was the test driver for Williams at that time, no real belief that he was going to end up racing a Williams. He was just lucky. He felt lucky to have an income, basically, still doing something to do with driving. And he ended up, as you said, winning three in a row. And I'm sure we'll come on to talk about it. Three very memorable wins. But yeah, for me, I mean, it would have been one of the seasons for the ages. If you'd had Mansell versus Prost in equal cars, that would have been quite something. Because although Prost was past his prime, he was almost 40 at that point, I still think he would have found a little bit to take Nigel on.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think there's quite a feeling. And in fact, I believe Adrian Newey said that Alain was sort of just doing what he needed to do that year. The McLaren wasn't really quick enough. The Benetton wasn't quite quick enough. He felt he had Damon. Although Damon did have some good days, obviously. Yeah. Prost was always going to win the championship. Would he have raised his game if Mansell had been there? You think probably yes, but would he have been able to raise it enough given that Mansell was really embedded in all that electronic gizmo, really got on top of it? Prost didn't really like it. So if I was doing a list of the greatest racing drivers, Alain Prost would probably be ahead of Nigel Mansell on my list. But in a Williams Renault with all the gizmos, I think probably Mansell is world champion. But I don't know if you'd agree.
Well, no, you've absolutely put your finger on it, because I think I did an interview with Patrick Head that year for Autosport, and I got Dennis Jenkinson at that time to leave Motorsport magazine and come and work for Autosport.
That's a remarkable move in itself.
A legendary Jenks, who was very much my mentor, if you like, in the beginning of my journalistic career, who won the 1955 Mille Miglia with Stirling Moss. He's one of the most iconic figures in our sport, as you well know, Kevin. Anyway, I said to him, what do you want to do? And he said, I want to interview these people. One of them was Prost, one was Senna, and one of them was Patrick Head. And we went together to see Patrick, and Patrick sort of was talking about this. And bear in mind, we're halfway through the 93 season, okay? And we get talking about the gizmos. And Patrick starts talking about how good Nigel Mansell was at understanding and remembering all the different settings on the G gain of the active ride suspension. And he said he was like a robot. He would come in after five practice laps and he'd say, right, it's doing this at -3, at plus one, it's doing this. And he remembered absolutely everything, literally. And he said, you know, basically he implied that Prost could not do that. So Prost found a way to drive it quickly, but Nigel found a way to absolutely maximise that car. So I think you're dead right that in a straight fight, Mansell certainly believes he would have beaten Prost. But anyway, it never happened.
Yeah, well, instead he made his own bit of motorsport history by going and, was it for a week, he was both F1 and IndyCar champion, which was rather... Actually, I've always thought that Donington Park, which is obviously one of Senna's most famous, a lot of people think it was greatest driver. I think he thought 85 Portugal was better, but it's in the mix. I do wonder what would have happened if Mansell had been in the car. Home ground, wasn't too bad in the wet himself. And of course, I think Patrick Head subsequently said they actually did have a setting within the car that could have raised the ride height. The problem that Damon Hill and Alain Prost were having was effectively aquaplaning because the cars were sitting too low. But actually, if they just thought about it, they could have cranked it up. And you'd have thought Mansell on home ground probably would have been, have been beaten by a minute and a half or whatever it was.
Yeah, no, it was over a minute, wasn't it? But I mean, it would have just been continuity from the season before. Mm. And also bear in mind, they had some history, those two. And Nigel didn't trust Prost at all because they'd been teammates at Ferrari, and he basically felt that Prost was using his sort of relationships politically behind the scenes to sort of make sure that he had the better car than Nigel, and there was a chassis swap at one point, and that's why Nigel, if you remember at the British Grand Prix, when he was a Ferrari driver, he said, I'm jacking this in now and I'm leaving Formula One. Do you remember?
Yeah,
it was
absolutely.
Because of all the politics. So I think he would have carried all of that over into the 93 season. It would have been unbelievably explosive.
Yeah, I think the difference is that Williams proved at that point that they could run two cars competitively and reliably, whereas Ferrari in the late 80s and early 90s, as we'll get onto a bit later, were still in their pre-Jean-Tort shambles era, really, where running one car was about as much as they could manage normally competitively. Well, let's get on to let's get on to McLaren and the Senna situation, because there's quite a lot going on there as well. We talk about big personalities, but I mean, Senna, they weren't sure that he was going to come and drive them. He did an IndyCar test with Penske as well. They'd lost Honda engines. Yeah. They didn't know when they were designing the car whether it was going to have a V8, a V10 or a V12 in it. So quite amazing, really, that McLaren managed to get those five wins in 93. It almost didn't happen.
So Ron Dennis, who was running McLaren at the time, was throwing out a lot of Hail Marys over that winter because obviously the end of 91... end of 92, Senna had been completely fed up with being pulverised by this active Williams of Mansell. And they just didn't have even though they had the Honda engines, they just didn't have the technology to match. Williams had a real head start. So then you lose the Honda engines, as you say, and of course Senna had tremendous influence behind the scenes with Honda.
He was a big engine man, actually.
Big engine man, and really knew how to work an engine, how to make the most of it. And anyway, so they ended up running the second spec of the Ford engine. So the works Ford team at that time was Benetton, run by Flavio Briatore, now back in Formula One again. Lead driver for 93, Michael Schumacher. Martin Brundle got biffed out because Bernie's friend Riccardo Patrese didn't have a drive with Williams anymore. And so Bernie put Patrese into the Benetton.
And they thought he'd have traction control and active suspension knowledge, which is all useless for them.
Exactly. And Martin ended up at Ligier, which wasn't the end of the world because it was quite a competitive car and got a few podiums with it. But yeah, so Senna's looking at this and thinking, I don't like the look of this at all. And he doesn't do anything at all over the winter. And then they're testing at Silverstone in February. Cold February Silverstone test. And you could do as much testing as you wanted in those days. And they've got Michael Andretti, who's come over from IndyCars to have a go at Formula One. And then they've got a test driver, Mika Häkkinen, who at that point had done a little bit with Lotus, but it was right at the beginning of his career. So they're testing with Andretti and Häkkinen. And then it turns up that Senna's coming back and he's going to do 2 days at Silverstone. So I look at this. I'm working at the time for ESPN, but I'm also covering the Formula One actually at the Grand Prix for the TV in America. And also I'm working with Autosport. And I thought, right, I'm going to go along to the second day because he's not driven a car for like 3 months. So I'll let him have a day to get up to speed and then I'll go and see what happens.
Good strategy.
And I had one of about two or three journalists, I think, there on the day. There's a guy from Japan, a woman from Japan and a guy from Italy and me. And I'm watching. I'm standing on the pit wall with Giorgio Ascanelli. Do you remember Giorgio? Mm. He was Senna's engineer.
He was quite worried about whether he was going to hold on to
Italian guy. Yeah, absolutely. And there's a sequence of laps in the afternoon where Senna goes, I can't remember what the benchmark, the fastest time that had been done up to that time was something like a 1:22 by Häkkinen or something like that. And it goes 1:22.3, 1:22.1, 1:22, 1:21.9, 1:21.7, 1:21.7, 1:21.5. So it's that kind of thing. He's just going bang, 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 bang. And Ascanelli's down the pit wall. I'm just a few meters from him. He goes like, he just puts his arms up in the air and he goes, he's back. And then afterwards, Senna does like a debrief, much shorter than they are these days. And he comes and sits with us upstairs in the Jimmy Brown Center, freezing cold. It's one of those smelly gas fires, you know, the ones that you have that you used to have at school. And he's got like a big sort of McLaren puffer jacket on, two caps on because it's so cold. And he sits there and he starts talking about how he wasn't sure if he wanted to do this anymore. His motivation was like a candle that was almost extinguished. And he said, then I thought, I have to come back and try. And then he starts talking about how driving, it was like an out-of-body experience for him because he was so used to anticipating the going into cops flat out in top. He would be already thinking about Maggots and Becketts previously. But because he was so out of practice, he was having to actually think about driving cops while he was driving cops. And it's sort of inside the mind of a racing driver. And that was what made Senna so special and so unique, was his intelligence, his commitment, but also the fact he was willing to share that kind of stuff. Mm. I mean, literally, I think me and the other two probably asked four questions in an hour, and he just talked. And it was just one of the best experiences of my entire life, and as you can imagine. And then a little bit later on, when Manish Pandey and Asif Kapadia were making the Senna documentary film, the famous one, they came to find me and said, have you got that tape? And I went and found it in the loft.
Oh, brilliant.
And it was corrupted.
Oh, no.
Otherwise, I'd be playing it for you today because it's the most brilliant, brilliant interview ever. But anyway, it's all written up in Autosport if you look in the bound volumes from February 1993. But one of the most cherished memories I've got, I had a lot of dealings with Senna, and particularly that year, and the guy was just on a completely different level.
And he kept McLaren guessing there, didn't he? It was a race by race deal.
$1 million a race.
Yeah, $1 million. Now, actually, I think Ron Dennis later did say, actually, the whole shenanigans with Senna and the money spent kind of curtailed their development a little bit, and it didn't help them. So although he was fantastic on those Saturdays and Sundays in delivering some sort of miraculous performances, overall, he wasn't driving things forward in the way that you say was in 91, where he was really getting into Honda and McLaren to push things forward. So I've always thought that 91 actually was a better season from Senna overall, even though 93 is more
famous. Yeah, I mean, he pulled a lot of rabbits out of hats in 1993. He won five races. He did some incredible things. But I remember talking to Flavio about about this situation around about February or March, when the deal was sort of announced that this is how it was going to be. It was race by race, $1 million a race. And they didn't say it was $1 million a race, but everybody knew it was. And I remember Flavio saying, this is completely insane. He said, I said, why don't you go to the bank and get $1 million and put it on a table and then get a bin bag and scoop the money into the bin bag? Then you'll see how completely insane this is.
That's fair.
It was
like enough,
July or something when he actually finally signed for the rest of the season. But it created a bit of a funny atmosphere within the team as well.
Yes, yeah. Well, it would do, wouldn't it? Yeah. I mean, he did manage to put, I suppose, one of the things that's notable about this period as well is even when you've got the best car, teams were still quite good at finding ways of not winning. Whereas these days, obviously Red Bull 2023, they had the quiz car and it was bang, 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 bang. Whereas, I mean, there was a miscommunication in the pits in Brazil when the rain came and Prost crashed and Senna beat Damon to take, a home victory. Donington, yes, fantastic lap of
too
the
many
gods,
pit stops, indecision.
I mean, I think Damon said there was no real direction from the pit wall. It's like, well, if you're coming in, we might have some tyres for you.
Prost made seven stops
for him. Yeah,
three for Senna as well.
Oh, in the drive-through when even McLaren weren't ready. It's just sort of incredible. And then the not dropping the car down. Prost had an engine failure while leading at Monza. There was a lot more throwing away of possible wins, which I suppose gave the opportunity for Senna to have those victories. But the only other person that managed to win that year, I think we should probably talk about Benetton, McLaren, Senna, Schumacher, dynamic as well. Schumacher managed to pull off a win in Estoril when he stopped early, got track position. Prost cruised up behind him and went, I think second's good enough to win the championship. I don't need to do anything. Whereas, again, if you've got a Mansell, I don't think he cares. I think he's going for it. Maybe that's why he was only one-time world champion and Alan was four. But nevertheless, you kind of want to see a bit of racing, don't you? But that's how Schumacher got his win.
Well, Schumacher, was driving that Benetton with the works Ford engine. As the year went on, they found a way to give McLaren equal spec with Benetton because they started out one development step behind. In those days, you could develop the engines during the season. I mean, crazy to think about it now because it's like they have a rationed number of engines and you can't develop them.
It was enormous success, wasn't it?
It was total success. It was cheaper. Everything was cheaper, of course, but it's all relative. But anyway, so Schumacher at that point was 24. Although there were fewer Grand Prix in those days than there are now, I think you'd probably compare him in terms of his stage of development as a driver and his age, you would compare him to Piastri today. He was probably about the same period in his development as Piastri was. And you could already, like with Piastri, you could already see this guy was something special. He'd won very, very spectacularly in Spa the year before. It was his first win. This, as you say, was his second win. And he clearly had the stuff. He'd also had a few run-ins with Senna, which was absolutely all about telling Senna that he was the guy he was going to have to pay attention to. I'm the guy you're going to have to watch out for from now on. And Senna knew that this guy was going to give him a lot of trouble. And they ran into each other a few times. Senna took a swing at him, in a test session in Germany. There was all sorts going on. Big, big characters. And Michael was right in Senna's face. And that was going on during 1993. Senna at this point is 33 years old. So you can't really compare to anyone today. He's like between Verstappen and Hamilton in age. He's obviously on at that level of greatness, but Hamilton's over 40 now and Verstappen is still only 27, 28, whatever. Whereas Senna was his absolute peak. He's 33 years old with all the experience that he had. He was in his absolute prime. And so, it was really interesting. You could see already through that 93 season that the following year was going to be absolutely monstrous with those two going at it, hammer and tongs. Mm. It was shaping up to be like 2021 was between Hamilton and Verstappen. And obviously, tragically, it ended, only four races in with Senna getting killed. But that for me was also extremely exciting. As someone who loves the sport, has done my whole life, I could see this was going to be an epic scrap between these two amazing talents.
Yeah, sort of bubbling up already, wasn't it? Yeah. And also between the teams. There was a little bit of needle because obviously Benetton were trying to keep the works or the most up-to-date Ford engines away from McLaren. McLaren were trying to get them. But then, interesting, when we spoke to, we did a 1993 special magazine in 2023, and both teams reckon their cars are actually pretty good. The basic B193 and the MP48 were good cars, but their flaws were the McLaren was 30 to 50 brake horsepower down on the Williams, at least, probably, because the Renault V10 carried on being developed as well and was a phenomenal engine. But then Benetton were upset because although they got the latest spec engines, Cosworth insisted on a particular way of using the traction control. They wouldn't cut the sparks. They'd only use the ignition and the throttle, which wasn't as good as what McLaren could do with theirs. So McLaren had less power but a more raceable engine. Just shows you, doesn't it? You've got to have everything together. So worth bearing in mind when people say, oh, Benetton had a more powerful engine. It wasn't quite as as straightforward as that, was it? They were just learning to win, really.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it, actually. It's what McLaren were claiming from last year. But you had that dream team around Schumacher there. You had Ross Brawn, you had Rory Byrne. Obviously, you didn't have Jean Todt. That was just purely Ferrari. But you had quite a lot of the ingredients that then went on to be the all-conquering Ferrari setup of a few years later. But yeah, it was, I mean, Briatore had sort of, had seen what was going on. Going back to the summer before, when all the Mansell contract shenanigans was going on, one of the little games Briatore played then was there was a bit of doubt about what was going on with Mansell, he could have floated this rumour around the paddock that actually Senna was going to come and drive for Benetton, and they were going to have a super team of Senna and Michael Schumacher for 1993 at Benetton. And Senna obviously was sort of trying to just generally make things move, so he kind of played along with it for a bit as well, and just to create that sort of agitation. So you had all these wonderful kind of games going on in the background, and Flavio was kind of really finding his confidence, and at that point as a team boss. And obviously the following year, 94, you know, they won their first World Championship.
Well, before we move on to some of the other teams, I thought it'd be nice to look at the driver ratings from that year. So I looked at the Autocourse top 10, and they put Ayrton Senna first, Prost second, Schumacher third, Jean Lacy fourth, ahead of Damon Hill in fifth. I thought maybe that was a little bit, I mean, I know Jean was dealing with a terrible Ferrari, which we'll get onto in a minute, but those top three in the championship, Senna was second, Prost was first, and Schumacher was fourth. But actually, that seems like a sensible top three to me.
I think that's absolutely fair. Senna was definitely the best driver that year, and Prost, you know, let's not forget, he did win seven races. And you know, for all that he had a big car advantage, you've still got to get the job done, haven't you? And against all the sort of circumstances that you talk about, so yeah, I mean, he deserved his championship. And Lacy's a bit of a weird one because I don't remember him. I mean, he had a few results. He got a podium in Monza, I remember, but he didn't. I don't remember him doing a great deal else. Whereas Damon was really impressive. He won Hungary. He got his first win in Hungary, and then Spa. I'll never forget Spa because we. In those days, we had so much freedom. I was working the pits for ESPN. Bob Varsha was the main commentator. Derek Daly was the colour commentator. And I was in the pit lane doing the pit reporting, as I then subsequently did for ITV a few years later. And in those days, you'd go wherever you wanted. And do you know the inside of the hairpin at Last Source? So I spent about half the race, 1993, literally standing next to the barrier on the inside of Last Source. And they were coming herring down, you know, down the main straight, across the start-finish line, and then pivoting like literally around me and then going off around the back. And I was kind of calling it from there and all that sort of thing. And you could see Damon was like properly on it that day. It was a really, really good drive. And the confidence he got from winning in Hungary, which is always one of his favourite racetracks, you know, he carried over that weekend. Then he carried over again into Monza. You really thought, hang on a second, this fella isn't just a sort of a test driver who's landed on his feet. This guy could actually have a run at it, which of course he subsequently did.
He tells quite a good story about Monza, doesn't he? Because he had that contretemps with Senna early on. He's having to come through the field and he basically gets up to second. He's going after Prost, and then apparently Alan was on the radio going, well, you know, just tell Damon to back, because Alan didn't want to drive any faster than he needed to. Yeah. And by that point in the season, Damon had been playing ball most of the time, apparently said back, no, tell Prost I'm racing.
Yeah.
And they just went, thanks, Damon. They obviously misheard. And before we found out what was going to happen, obviously the Renault blew up in the back of Prost. So, that problem never actually came to fruition. But he got his three wins, didn't he, Damon? Which I think he deserved.
Oh,
he deserved
undoubtedly.
Yeah. I think probably the Lacy in fourth is perhaps a sympathy. I mean, let's talk about Ferrari. I mean, 92 was absolutely horrendous with their twin flawed concept. They were miles off the pace. They only scored 21 points. They only did marginally better in 1993. They were a bit close to the pace overall. But I think consecutive seasons of not winning a race, but it triggered the changes that actually led to one of the most dominant periods in F1 history.
Yeah, and of course the foundation for it was flawed. That was the problem, is that they had basically the design team was based in the UK, and they were building the cars in Italy, and the whole concept of it was wrong, basically. And this is in the days before Zoom and Teams, where you could actually have meetings in real time and all that kind of thing. So, you know, there was just a disconnect, and as is classic in those situations, the engine department was blaming the chassis department, the chassis department was blaming the engine department, the race team operations people are blaming everybody for not giving them a fast enough car, and it was just one of those things. And, you know, Lacy shouldn't really have been there. If you remember, Kevin, he had already signed a contract with Williams to go there when Mansell went back. Mansell went back because Alesi said to Frank Williams, I don't actually want to come now because Ferrari want me. And I've always wanted to drive for Ferrari. And he was ruled by his heart and not his head. Mm. So he got out of the Williams contract and went to Ferrari to drive a terrible car when he could have been driving that Williams that Mansell won the championship in and the Williams that Prost won the championship in. So that's the story of Alesi's career, basically. He could have been a two- or three-time world champion, but instead of which, he had those sort of very troubled years at Ferrari. And it wasn't, as you say, until 97 when Jean Todt arrived, and then it was Ross Brawn that they actually moved everything back to Maranello. Gearbox, you know, design, R&D, the whole lot. And then they all started singing off the same hymn sheet, and then they couldn't lose after that.
Yeah, I was going to say, Jean Todt actually joined, and he was the first piece in the jigsaw. He joined actually during the 93 season, but obviously couldn't really do anything. But within a year...
sports cars. He'd been running Peugeot sports. I was in Le Mans 92 and 93.
Which they won, of course.
They dominated, yeah, exactly. And he was very exciting when he got that gig.
Yeah, but within a year, they'd won a Grand Prix. Mm-hmm. Within, 3 years, they'd managed to get a hold of Schumacher. And then they got Ross Brawn. By the late 90s, they were kind of ready, weren't they? But at this point, they were still very much playing second fiddle, or third or fourth even. we should also talk about a new arrival to the grid in terms of teams in 1993, a team that's still there in a very different form.
Yeah.
But obviously, Mercedes came back into the sport, but with Sauber. So they were sort of... Is it going to be a works Mercedes team? It didn't actually end up like that, of course, but it did bring Sauber again from sports cars into Formula One.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if the listeners look on YouTube at the you mentioned the European Grand Prix at Donington, for example, you look on YouTube and watch the highlights of that race, you'll see this black car near the front of the grid. And that was Karl Wendlinger in the Sauber. Mercedes and Sauber had won Le Mans. They'd been very successful in sports cars. And Schumacher had actually driven for that team at Le Mans in 1991, which was a great race. And basically they came in, but Mercedes were quite cautious. It was really interesting. It was the first time they'd come back to Formula One since they left in 1955 after the Le Mans tragedy that year. And it was quite cautious because it just said concept by Mercedes-Benz on the side of the car. but everyone knew that they were kind of funding this. And it was Peter Sauber was running the team out of the place where they still are today, which is Hinwil in Switzerland, just outside Zurich. And they had this car, and it can't have been a bad car because it was right at the front of the grid as I say, we're mixing it with Prost and Hill and Senna in Donington. And they had Karl Wendlinger and JJ Leto as their two drivers. But it was a curiosity, I would say, that year that they'd come back. And then, of course, it was all the lot of shenanigans because obviously McLaren did everything they could to get that Mercedes-Benz engine, which of course they got, and then that set them up for the success they subsequently had in the late 1990s. But yeah, it was great to see a new team come in, and of course credit to them, they've survived this long.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, the car was pretty good. It was fifth fastest on raw speed and was seventh in the Constructors' Championship, which, yeah, not a bad...
With better drivers, they might have got...
Yeah, although Wendlinger at that time was pretty highly
rated. He was quick, but
he wasn't
F1 experienced.
No.
And he was a little bit erratic. Leto was a solid driver, but he was, you know, he'd been sort of a number two guy previously. So I think if you'd had like a Martin Brundle at that point in his career or whatever, who was doing good things at Ligier or various other people, then I think maybe they could have been a little higher.
Interesting, Martin Brundle was sixth in the autocourse rating, so backing up your point, he did a pretty good job. But
I thought he was one of his best seasons, to be honest. Well, yeah.
He was on a bit of a high, obviously not losing the drive, but he'd worked out of the top team. He'd been compared pretty well, actually, with Marcus Schumacher at Benetton. With hindsight, a better season than perhaps was thought at the time from Martin. So, yeah, operating at a high level at that point.
Yeah, and he was a really good racer, Martin. He was, by his own admission, he probably was maybe a tiny bit off it in qualifying relative to where he would like to have been in order to perhaps stay in that Benetton sort of environment. But he was a formidable racer and very consistent, very reliable. And he bagged some really good podiums. But it must have been disappointing for him, you know, to drop out of the Benetton. Well, I know it was because he told me many times, but it was disappointing for him to drop out of the Benetton in that way particularly.
And given the way that Riccardo Patrese went at Benetton, they probably would have been better off sticking with Brundle, wouldn't they? Sort of sad end, really, to Patrese. He's actually quite, you know, well, at that point, record-breaking career. Well, before we finish off, I think there are a couple of other talking points from the season. Perhaps Senna outside of the car at Japan with a certain driver coming in who got in the way and annoyed him.
Yeah, so Senna won in Japan, but he was I think he had a penalty of some sort, a drive through or something like that, where he basically kind of fell out of position. He had to come back through again,
I think he was lapping Eddie, wasn't he?
I know he was coming up behind. Irvine was battling with another car, and basically he didn't show him enough respect in Senna's view, and so he went and confronted him after. Even though he won the race, he went and confronted him afterwards, and basically said, you know, you need to show more respect, and because Eddie, you know, had huge respect for Senna. He actually had his helmet colours, if you remember, or version of it. You know, he had that much admiration for Senna, and he didn't like this at all. And his sort of his contrary nature, shall we call it, came out, and he was pretty lippy to Senna in his sort of, as you say, as a rookie. And Senna hit him basically.
Yeah.
Senna was very emotionally driven like that.
Yes, well, I was going to say, we actually haven't even talked about, I mean, Michael Andretti had a terrible season, really, and didn't see out the year. And they brought Mick Hakkinen, as you say, as the test driver, and his first outing at Estoril, he out-qualified Senna. I don't think Eton was particularly happy about that either.
He wasn't happy at all about that. No, he really wasn't. Michael was a really strange story because, he'd been doing really well in IndyCars. He was flying, and he made that swap. To come to Formula One, and in those days you had, you know, unlimited testing, so he had a lot of preparation time. But one of the problems he had, I think, is he never really committed to the life of a Formula One driver. He thought he could do it from his home in Nazareth, Pennsylvania, and basically commuted by Concorde across to Europe for the races and things. So he wasn't. He just, I mean, the whole gesture, or that lack of gesture, if you want, it's just reeked of a lack of commitment. And he tried to overcompensate for that by overdriving the car. And he had some huge shunts. I mean, a massive accident at the start in Brazil, I remember. We kind of have a look at that on YouTube, because I'm barreling around the outside of turn one. You know, that's a place you don't want to be crashing. You certainly don't want to be cartwheeling there. And all of that stuff. He just never quite got it together. And he had strange body language around the paddock. Because I was working for ESPN, we had to interview him like multiple times a weekend. And it was one of those really like, oh, blimey. You know, it's like... What do I ask him this time?
It's such a shame because he was so good to watch in early 90s, early 90s IndyCar. But yeah, when you think that young drivers now will move to, say, let's say, move to Italy to be near Prema at Formula 2 or Formula 3 level, never mind, you know, being in F1, travelling. I mean, I suppose Concorde would have... Younger listeners, Concorde was a supersonic passenger plane we haven't had for over 20 years, which I find shocking. go to Duxford to see one. That's a random tangent there. But before we finish off, James, like, I've always thought 93 is a bit of an end of an era, because you've got that podium at the end at Adelaide. It's the last McLaren drive that Senna did. It's Alain Prost's last drive. The gizmos were about to go. And then 94 looked very different, even before, obviously, the events of San Marino. 93 was kind of the end of almost that sort of Senna, Mansell, Prost era, really, wasn't it?
I think that's a really good way of putting it, Kevin. I mean, it was the end of a number of eras. But for me, you know, who always looks at this primarily on a human level, that the period had been dominated by Senna versus Prost. It was the box office battle that put Formula One really well and truly on the map at that time. It was irresistible. The very, very, you know, raw confrontations between them in 1989 and 1990 to clinch world championships by driving each other off the racetrack, you know, and it was just so intense. And here they were, Senna going, you know, his final time, Prost's final race, as you say, it was known he was retiring. He announced his retirement after he won the title in Portugal. So it was already known that this would be his last Grand Prix. And therefore, he was no longer a threat to Senna. And therefore, you know, it was the last time they were ever together on a podium. And actually what happened after that is they started to reconcile with each other. And they were talking a lot in the early part of 1994. Before Senna got killed at Imola, they'd actually really reconcile with each other, and it's a sort of untold story. The fact everyone thinks it was this unbelievable hostility, which it was, but the moment Prost stopped and he was no longer a threat to Senna, it was all sweetness and light.
I think he didn't even ring Alain the week up to San Marino. Yeah. I think they spoke across the weekend. So, strange, wasn't it? I suppose at that point Senna was just about to realise that he was now the target, as opposed to, he'd always had Prost to aim at, and now. this young German bloke was going to be aiming at him. So it set things up nicely, basically.
It set everything up brilliantly for 1994. But of course, they got rid of all the gizmos, as you say. And unfortunately, although Benetton coped with that in their own way, Williams, the car didn't really work without them. They'd been so reliant on them. It took a lot of time for Williams to get that car sorted out. And unfortunately, that was that period when Senna was driving for them. And obviously, you know, four races in, he lost his life.
Yeah, I don't think 1994 will be appearing in this series. Well, before we finish, are there any final thoughts you'd like to put forward as to why 1993 is your favourite F1 season? A closing thought?
Well, hopefully, I think people who aren't familiar with the season that maybe been listening will realise it was a period of huge personalities, huge characters. And Formula One today, you know, I've been doing it for 36 years now. It's never been stronger as a sport, certainly not commercially, and in many, many ways as it is today. And we've got some brilliant drivers and some brilliant personalities, and things like Drive to Survive have done so much to give a window into non-aficionado fans as to the intensity of the life of a top Grand Prix driver. But, you know, you didn't really see that as an outsider in 93, but if you were there and you were close to it, and if you were following and reading in Autosport and things like that, you got a sense of these gigantic personalities. And it was, for me, how old was I? 26 or something. And it was just phenomenally exciting time. And, you know, I loved every second of it. It was amazing.
And for those who are sort of technically minded, you can make a strong case for it being because Formula One is a technical as well as a sporting exercise. Of course it is. And that's almost, you know, the cars aren't as sophisticated. Obviously, the powertrains are, but the chassis, you know, active ride, traction control, there was ABS, Williams were testing the CVT, Benetton tried four-wheel steering,
yeah,
all sorts of crazy stuff. It probably did have to stop, because otherwise they'd have spent, I mean, they ended up spending loads of money anyway, didn't they? But they'd have spent even more money. So it probably had to stop at some point. But as a technological peak, 93 sort of stands, it's definitely one of those sort of milestone moments, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the ABS and all the rest, you say traction control. But I mean, they needed to return the cars back to the drivers, because what people want to see is the best drivers in the world being pushed to the limits. It's man or woman versus machine. And that's what people want to see. And so we were getting too far away from that, and so they banned it at the end of that year. So as you say, it was a big kind of full stop, new paragraph, and a whole new chapter really of Formula One that followed after that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that seems a very good way to finish. So thank you very much, James Allen, for his thoughts on 1993. Thank you very much for listening. Do you agree? Is 1993 your favourite season? If it isn't, then let us know at allsport@allsport.com. Which season would you pick out and why? Maybe if we have enough people going for the same year, maybe we'll do a separate podcast covering that off. But thank you very much for listening. We'll be back soon with another Allsport podcast.